And what was striking in this young baby's blood smear was that there was so much overwhelming infection, bacteria, that you could see the bacteria in the white cells under the microscope. And the other thing was striking is that beside those white cells were sickled red blood cells.
My name is Jonathan Alisea, and you're listening to the Rare Disease Report podcast. Roughly 1 in 10 people in the United States suffer from a type of rare disease, be it sickle cell, acute myeloid leukemia, ACTH deficiency, or Wolff-Hirschhorn syndrome, to name just a few of the nearly 7,000 observed rare diseases. In the U.S., a rare disease is defined as having fewer than 200,000 cases, as established by the Orphan Drug Act of 1983. Individuals with these conditions may have limited to no treatment options. Researching therapies or cures may be challenging or virtually impossible due to lack of funding or access to patients. And of course, a lack of awareness on the part of the medical community, patients, government agencies, and the general public is likely at the root of these sweeping issues. To even begin to search for solutions, one must ask themselves the following questions. How do we define this disease, and how do we recognize it? Who does it affect? Why? What are its presentations, and what is the patient quality of life? And yet, this just scratches the surface. We need to start somewhere, right? The purpose of the Rare Disease Report podcast is to be a one-stop information hub for all those seeking to expand their knowledge and awareness of rare diseases. Perhaps you're a primary care provider interested in expanding your diagnostic and care toolbox. Or you're an interested party hoping to get a better assessment of the rare disease landscape. Each episode will feature a deep dive look into a rare disease with a relevant expert. We'll look at diseases with a few thousand cases, and those with only 100 or fewer. We will approach each condition with the same set of questions, all designed to better define the disease's history, pathology, and research status. All in all, this will be a platform for experts and advocates of rare diseases to tell their story the way they want it to be told, and bring the latest and most pertinent information to the table. For this episode, we will look at sickle cell disease. I spoke with Kim Smith-Whitley, the newly appointed Executive Vice President and Head of Research and Development at Global Blood Therapeutics, the developer of Oxalitor, or Oxbryta, a first-of-its-kind oral medication for sickle cell. Dr. Smith-Whitley is a world-renowned hematologist and sickle cell disease thought leader. Her work has primarily been based in pediatric hematology and developing clinical initiatives to support evidence-based clinical care. We spoke about the historical and current state of sickle cell screening and care, new research, as well as notable barriers that preclude patients from getting optimal care. In our conversation, she drew heavily on her personal and clinical experiences, offering detailed insights into her practice. Suffice it to say, we covered a lot of ground while staying committed to one goal, bringing you the most up-to-date and accurate rare disease report. Thank you so much, Dr. Smith-Whitley, for joining me today on Rare Disease Reports. Great to have you.
Thank you.
So today we're going to talk about sickle cell disease. Can you just first start off telling me a bit about yourself, your story, and how you got into this clinical domain, if you don't mind?
One of the things that I enjoyed growing up was actually providing care. It started off providing care to animals early on. I thought I was going to grow up to be a vet, and that transformed in my college years as I began to have more experiences, you know, taking care of patients in different settings, shadowing, doing those different things. And fortunately, I became very interested in pediatrics early on. and then subsequently interested in caring for those living with sickle cell disease. I've always been inspired by a challenge. And one of the things that was striking to me as I was doing my training was the disparity between care for those with pediatric cancer versus those with sickle cell disease. And so my desire as I started in my true professional career as an attending at CHOP was to bring many of the benefits and access to care protocols to sickle cell that I was seeing other patients benefit from.
To sort of now segue into sickle cell as a disease, can you just explain, kind of give an overview of sickle cell disease, its presentations, and the sort of challenges that patients face with it?
When I think about sickle cell disease, I can't help but think about sickle cell in an historic perspective. And the reason I think it's so important to look at sickle cell over the years is that it really emphasizes the disparities. And it's part of the reason that I'm so passionate about taking care of individuals with sickle cell disease. The first U.S. patient described with sickle cell disease was in 1910. And it really wasn't until the 90s, the 1990s, that we had a disease-modifying agent for sickle cell disease. And then again, not until 2017 when we had our next FDA-approved drug, and then Oxbryta in November of 2019. So I just put therapies in the context of sickle cell disease so that you can understand also that as I describe the clinical challenges, it is emphasized what few therapies we have to address these challenges. When I started medical school in the decade of, late 1980s, we did not have newborn screening for sickle cell disease universally here in the US. So my introduction to individuals with sickle cell disease were individuals who developed problems and then came to our attention because of these concerns. So one of the most striking memories that I have in my career is taking care of a 2-year-old who came to the hospital incredibly sick with high fevers, and we couldn't understand initially what the source of the infection was. And I got a call from the micro lab to come upstairs and look at a blood smear. And usually on a blood smear, you can see red cells, white cells, platelets, the red cells carrying oxygen to the tissues, the white cells helping to fight bacteria, and the platelets to help you clot. We had a potentially life-threatening infection because of a condition that they didn't even know of, and that's that their baby had sickle cell disease. So fortunately, around the same time, penicillin was being studied as a way to prevent infections in children with sickle cell disease, very young age. We had always had the capacity to identify sickle cell in the newborn period, but never a public health reason for screening because we supposedly weren't going to do anything different for those babies, according to many health authorities at the time. So with penicillin twice a day, every day, proved to decrease infections 92%, we then had the background for newborn screening. So fast forward, when I came to Philadelphia for my fellowship, we then had newborn screening in the United States so that babies could be diagnosed with sickle cell within the first couple of weeks of life, get to a hematologist, and start on life-saving antimicrobials, penicillin, twice a day, every day to prevent overwhelming infections. So historically, we used to wait for problems to happen before children with sickle cell disease were diagnosed. Now, children with sickle cell disease are diagnosed early in the first few weeks of life, and they are brought to medical attention for life-saving therapies. we're still missing some of the individuals with sickle cell disease in the U.S. And those are primarily individuals that were born before newborn screening. So it's not uncommon for us to meet somebody in a room where you're talking about their child having sickle cell disease and diagnosing the parent with a sickle cell syndrome. And it's not uncommon for individuals who are coming to the U.S. from other countries who may not have had the benefit of newborn screening in their home country to actually then come here and be diagnosed with sickle cell. And we really need better methods of capturing that population, because I think that's an underserved population that could benefit from more widespread screening.
I wrote a sort of feature piece on just generally like disparities in sickle cell care and sort of talking with experts about these gaps in care. You talked a bit about the screening, and then there's the other end of the treatment and getting treatment out to these patients. And I wanted to sort of gauge your perspective on that end as well, on gaps in treatment and ensuring patients with sickle cell have access to care at the moment. So I don't know if you want to comment on that.
No, I'm glad you raised this, Jonathan, because I think that this is a very important issue. And when you asked me earlier about the clinical presentation of sickle cell disease, it's not just the fever and the infections in early life that we see, but also the unpredictable pain episodes. And unfortunately, that's one of the predominant characteristics of the clinical presentation of sickle cell disease. And just as that first individual who came to the U.S. in 1904 but was reported in 1910, that individual experienced a respiratory illness and then pain. And so it is not uncommon for individuals to seek medical care because of pain or because of a respiratory syndrome called acute chest syndrome, which is the number one reason for death in adults with sickle cell disease. And unfortunately, just as that individual was treated back in the early 1900s with supportive care, things that could treat the infectious component of acute chest syndrome, which is just one aspect of it, and medications to relieve his pain, but no therapies that change the course of that pain episode. It's just striking to me that we're still doing supportive care for pain and acute chest syndrome. And I think that that is one of the most striking disparities to me, is the lack of robust therapeutics that we can use to make individuals better once they have problems. The lack of robust therapeutics that we have in order to prevent problems in high-risk individuals. And then the reality of early mortality is unfortunately another complication of sickle cell, with the average lifespan of males being 42 years with the SS form of sickle cell and 48 years for females, and not really moving the bar appreciably in that over the last three decades. And so I think that that just briefly summarizes some of the disparities. The other disparity is very personal for individuals living with sickle cell disease. And that's because sickle cell primarily affects communities of color. And the stigma associated with sickle cell in that context, as well as the context of needing to go to hospitals for pain management and being classified as drug seeking. And so I think that that is the other stigma that we need to address that further widens the gap in care, are those biases that we really need to address as a medical community and as compassionate individuals here in the U.S.
See, as you're telling me all this, I can't help but think that initial conversation with families and, you know, with children must be difficult after the diagnosis. Do you think you can sort of speak to this initial conversation, kind of what that experience is like with these families that are struggling with sickle cell disease or that may have the sickle cell trait?
You know, one of the things that I think is so important in conversations with anyone that you're talking to, that you're about to tell their child has a chronic illness, is really compassion and respect. And so often those two components are missing in the communication to individuals with sickle cell disease about their child's diagnosis of sickle cell disease or trait. Unfortunately, here in the US, families are still finding out about their child having sickle cell trait with a letter in the mail. So that is a huge gap in care that needs to be addressed. But when I have a conversation with parents who bring their child to me because their little one has been suspected of having sickle cell, that means that they have gotten a call from a pediatrician or a neonatologist from the hospital where they were born and been told that their child has a newborn screening result that is suspicious for sickle cell disease and that they need to go to usually a sickle cell center in order to get further care. And it's very difficult that family, imagine the time from getting that call from the pediatrician until actually getting in my office. And this is my opportunity to advocate for having a really robust sickle cell team. It's not just me, it's my social workers, it's my nurses, it's my community health workers who are the true heroes in sickle cell care. Because when that individual hangs up the phone, I know my nurse or my social worker is calling them pretty rapidly after that initial phone call to not only schedule an appointment, but to have a conversation with families about what sickle cell disease is and where to get their information from so that they're not on the internet reading about really tragic outcomes in individuals with sickle cell disease that may be based on old information. When in the 70s, we used to report that about 40% of children would live to be 20 years of age. Now we're at 90 to 93%. And so we want those families to hear those positive messages about what could be if we keep their child in good care for that type of outcome. So the first thing I want to do is instill hope. The other thing is that we really need to educate that individual as to what that means, that sickle cell, not only for that child, but for that family, right? And so we make sure that the family understands how to take care of that baby when they leave the office, to give penicillin twice a day, to watch for fever, and then to work with us to build that trust between their medical team and that family so that they know they can come to us, call us for any concerns, any problems, because it's only a team and good communication that is going to keep that child healthy. I actually introduced transition from pediatric to adult focused care right in that first meeting because I told them that our goal is to be sitting here 20 years from now having a very challenging discussion about separating and moving on to adult focused care. And that's my goal, to keep that individual as healthy and as productive, doing everything that that family would have wanted for that child before they got that diagnosis of sickle cell. And then the other thing is to make sure that we also address the context of living with having a child with an inherited condition. What does that mean for the parents? Do they know what their sickle cell status is? Do they know if they have trait? Do they know if they have a mild form of disease? What about other family members who have been born? Are there older siblings that may have been born before sickle cell screening came to their state? Because when sickle cell newborn screening first came to some states, it was targeted. It was only meant for individuals of color. And you know, sometimes it's not easy to figure out who those individuals may be, especially since we know that sickle cell really followed an interesting pattern in the distribution of sickle hemoglobin genes throughout the Mediterranean, throughout the Caribbean, throughout India. So we have sickle cell in other populations that may not be easily suspected at first, right? So now that we have universal screening, we have many families who are also dealing with the fact of, well, I thought this was a Black disease. So, you know, why does my child have sickle cell disease? And really having conversations about the fact that you don't have to have a sickle gene in order to have a child with sickle cell disease. And that's really curious to some families. You know, 65% of individuals with sickle cell have the SS form, where they've inherited one sickle gene from each parent. But you can have a parent with C trait, a parent with beta thalassemia trait, a family member with E trait, that when that combines with S, they also have a child living with sickle cell disease. And so these are the kinds of conversations that we have with that earlier discussion, what we need to do to keep your baby healthy and growing and thriving, what we need to do to provide hope, and what we need to do to make sure that sickle cell has been addressed for the entire family.
You mentioned earlier that care team and like building that trust, that's so important. And that's something that for these communities, I'm sure it means a lot. So it's good having those resources you can trust, you can like those human resources that you can trust. And that, like you said, goes a long way and can make that difference. To switch gears, and this is kind of getting a bit more clinical, you know, thinking about where we are in terms of treatment and research, I want to sort of gauge your outlook on what the state of research is at this moment and where we still need to go with that, sort of where's that trending?
One of the reasons that I'm so excited to be joining GBT, Global Blood Therapeutics, in May is just for this reason. There are so many therapies in the pipeline that will be able to benefit individuals with sickle cell disease. I had a conversation yesterday with a family of a 13-year-old who has been on hydroxyurea for many, many years, and just over the last few months has had some particular challenges and has had blood transfusions to which she has had reactions to. So she's recognized that blood is being different from her own with an immune reaction called red cell alloimmunization. It's going to make it difficult, possibly, for her to be transfused in the future. And when I introduced the concept of having a medication that could be used with hydroxyurea to increase her hemoglobin and to lower the likelihood of her dropping her counts and needing blood, may lower the likelihood of her having pain episodes, this family was over the moon. So to have Oxbryta or Voxelotor is an inhibitor of sickle hemoglobin polymerization, where we can get an increase in hemoglobin, a healthier red blood cell, was just amazing to that family. So I'm so excited that there are other therapeutics out there. There are therapeutics such as crizanlizumab, which can be used to decrease pain episodes. And one of the wonderful things about joining Global Blood Therapeutics is we have two agents, a new generation of an inhibitor of sickle hemoglobin polymerization coming down the pike, as well as a new type of drug, an anti-P selectin that is similar to that crizanlizumab that could be used to lower the incidence of pain episodes in individuals with sickle cell. So I'm excited about some of these therapies. And there are other agents out there that are directed at different pathways of being able to address how to make sickle cell better. I tell a story all the time when I was a resident and I was teaching medical students about sickle cell disease. I had this cartoon which had a healthy red blood cell on one side, a sickle crescent-shaped cell on the other, and an arrow going this way from the healthy red cell to the sickle cell, and an arrow going the other way from the sickle cell to the healthy red cell. And I would talk about how sickle hemoglobin would polymerize in various situations. And I had a very basic model to describe the underlying pathophysiology of sickle cell. Now, when I talk about sickle cell disease, those arrows that really give some understanding of the underlying pathophysiology of why sickle cell causes problems are over 40 arrows, right? So I can talk about adhesion. I can talk about hemolysis and free heme and nitric oxide and so many different targets. The thing I'm excited about is I really believe if we can make a healthier red cell, then some of those other targets downstream will not need to be addressed, because we can truly give hope through providing a healthier red cell, which will hopefully eliminate many of the complications associated with sickle cell disease if we can do it the right way.
For our listeners who may be having to deal with potentially sickle cell patients, whether it's a primary care provider or specialist, what sorts of advice or nuggets of wisdom would you want to give them?
One of the things that I think is most challenging in our community right now is getting good care to patients across the lifespan. So to individuals living with sickle cell disease, I worry that they feel isolated after a while, that they cannot find that expert that's going to provide that compassionate, evidence-based care. It is very important for people to realize that there is more to individuals with sickle cell disease that cause problems other than pain. Every organ is involved in complications, both short-term and long-term, in individuals with sickle cell disease. There are things that they can't see or feel that are happening in their bodies that they need medical care for. We have screening tools now to identify problems either before they occur. We can identify those at high risk for stroke, which is a significant problem in those with sickle cell disease. In fact, sickle cell used to be the number one cause of pediatric stroke before we had this screening tool, which is an ultrasound machine that when laid against the side of the temple, you can hear how fast blood is flowing through certain vessels in the brain. And if it's very speedy, we know that those individuals may have a higher risk for stroke, and we can intervene by putting them on transfusions to reduce stroke risk. And so now sickle cell is probably number 6 or 7 on the list for pediatric stroke because we've had these interventions. And then for adults, it's going to be very important to keep their eyes healthy so that they get annual eye exams and other things to make sure that their kidneys are healthy, that their lungs are healthy, that they don't have something called pulmonary hypertension. And so all of those different things are very, very challenging to stay on top of. And I just am worried about the access to physicians who understand how to screen and how to treat, how to get Oxbryta to patients, how to get crizanlizumab to patients, how to manage hydroxyurea therapy, and then to curative therapies. What are those possibilities? And so having access to sickle cell expertise, to sickle cell therapeutics, is really what I'm hoping individuals in our community, both individuals living with sickle cell disease as well as healthcare providers, are hearing, that there are new things coming down the pike, and that we want to make sure that individuals with sickle cell disease have access to these new therapies and to these screening modalities. And so really trying to connect individuals with sickle cell disease to good care across the lifespan is what I'm hoping we can do. And if we have therapies like Oxbryta and companies like Global Blood Therapeutics who are going to be interested in making sure that individuals with sickle cell disease not only survive, but thrive, then we have the hope of making sickle cell disease more like a chronic condition that individuals can live with and can thrive with and do all of the things that they wanted to do before they found out or before they realized that they were living with a chronic illness, and increasing survival for these individuals long-term. So that is really what I'm hoping therapeutics will bring, is other means of treating, other ways of helping. And with that being firmly established, then the second piece will be trying to get individuals to those therapies and making sure that they're accessible.
Well, Dr. Smith-Whitley, thank you so much for joining me today. This was wonderful.
I'm glad that we've had the opportunity, and I really want to thank you, Jonathan, for highlighting sickle cell disease so early in your series. I think that this is really an opportunity to raise awareness about sickle cell, and I really want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to do just that.
And that was your Rare Disease Report. Stay tuned next month as we look at Fabry disease with nephrologist Dr. Eric Wallace. In the meantime, check out all rare disease coverage at hcplive.com and follow the Rare Disease Report on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And finally, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and Spotify. Once again, I'm your host, Jonathan Alisea, and thank you for joining me on the inaugural Rare Disease Report podcast.